others, not only in those who profit by them, but in those who suffer by them. If you suggest a doubt as to the morality of these institutions, it is said directly, "You are a dangerous experimenter, a utopian, a theorist, a despiser of the laws. You would shake the basis upon which society rests." If you lecture upon morality or political economy, official bodies will be found to make this request to the government: that henceforth science be taught not only with sole reference to free exchange, to liberty, property, and justice, as has been the case up to the present time, but also and especially with reference to the facts and legislation contrary to liberty, property, and justice that regulate French industry; that in public lecterns salaried by the Treasury, the professor abstain rigorously from endangering in the slightest degree the respect due to the laws now in force. So that if a law exists that sanctions slavery or monopoly, oppression or plunder in any form whatever, it must not even be mentioned, for how can it be mentioned without damaging the respect that it inspires? Still further, morality and political economy must be taught in connection with this law, that is, under the supposition that it must be just only because it is law. Another effect of this deplorable perversion of the law is that it gives to human passions and to political struggles, and in general to politics, properly so called, an exaggerated importance. I could prove this assertion in a thousand ways, but I shall confine myself by way of an illustration to bringing it to bear upon a subject which has of late occupied everybody's mind: universal suffrage. Whatever may be thought of it by the adepts of the school of Rousseau, which professes to be very far advanced, but which I consider 20 centuries behind, universal suffrage, taking the word in its strictest sense, is not one of those sacred dogmas with respect to which examination and doubt are crimes. Serious objections may be made to it. In the first place, the word universal conceals a gross sophism. There are in France 36 million inhabitants. To make the right of suffrage universal, 36 million electors should be reckoned. The most extended system reckons only 9 million. 3 persons out of 4, then, are excluded. And more than this, they are excluded by the fourth. Upon what principle is this exclusion founded? Upon the principle of incapacity. Universal suffrage, then, means universal suffrage of those who are capable. In point of fact, who are the capable? Are age, sex, and judicial condemnations the only conditions to which incapacity is to be attached? On taking a nearer view of the subject, we may soon perceive the reason why the right of suffrage depends upon the presumption of incapacity. The most extended system differing from the most restricted in the conditions on which this incapacity depends, and which constitutes not a difference in principle, but in degree. This motive is that the elector does not stipulate for himself, but for everybody. If, as the Republicans of the Greek and Roman tone pretend, the right of suffrage had fallen to the lot of everyone at his birth, it would be an injustice to adults to prevent women and children from voting. Why are they prevented? Because they are presumed to be incapable. And why is incapacity a reason for exclusion? Because the elector does not reap alone the responsibility of his vote. Because every vote engages and affects the community at large. Because the community has a right to demand some assurances as regards the acts upon which its well-being and its existence depend. I know what might be said in answer to this. I know what might be objected. But this is not the place to settle a controversy of this kind. What I wish to observe is this, that this same controversy